opening the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee on Tuesday, March 3rd, 2015. Colleagues, today we're going to have an informational hearing on the PUC report investigations into the effectiveness of solar programs in Oregon. And then I'm going to open a public hearing on the two bills that are posted in OLIS for discussion today. We do have a lot of people signed up to give testimony on these bills. And there is an overflow room. Hearing room E is set up as an overflow room for anyone who is out in the hall and who may not have a seat. You're welcome to go there to watch the committee hearings. With that, I'm going to go ahead and open the informational meeting on the PUC report and ask Jason Eisendorfer from the PUC to come up. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisendorfer, Program Director of the Public Utility Commission. Directly behind me is John Kreider, a Senior Utility Analyst, so when you start asking me tough questions, I may call him up. There we go. Thank you. You asked me here to give a very broad overview of the state of solar energy in the state, and we are relying on two documents, primary documents, both of which came out of direction from the legislature. The first is the investigation into the effectiveness of solar programs. This was delivered to the legislature in July of last year in compliance with AB 2893, which directed the PUC to report out on the general status of solar energy in Oregon, as well as look at the costs and benefits of existing solar incentive programs. The second is the solar photovoltaic volumetric incentive program. This was delivered to you in January of this year in compliance with 3039 from 2009, and that bill directs the PUC to report every 2 years on the effectiveness of the volumetric incentive rate pilot, which offers participants long-term payments based on the actual output generated from solar PV systems. There's a third document. Actually, this is one that came out just about a week ago from it's a group called PNUC. It's the Pacific Northwest Utilities Conference Committee, which is an informal collaboration of investor and consumer-owned utilities in the region that looks at energy and power supply issues in the Northwest. And this report is on the costs and benefits of distributed solar installations in the Northwest. So those are the three documents I'm going to be relying on today. As you know, solar PV converts sunlight directly into electric current, which means that during operation there's no reliance on fossil fuel and there are no environmental emissions associated with it. The installation sizes range from 1 to 10 kilowatts to larger central station projects that can have a peak output of 100 megawatts or more. Oregon has long promoted development of solar energy through a variety of policies and programs, and we'll talk about the range of programs for customers and developers in a couple of slides. And while solar right now only represents a small fraction of the electric generation in the state, it is a growing resource from 1,000 installations in 2009 to over 8,000 in 2013 and over 10,000 right now. So there are a number of benefits from solar. Solar PV on a rooftop helps a customer buy less energy from the utility, and the utility has to buy less energy from the market during peak periods of the day. As I said before, there are no environmental emissions during operation. Distributed generation reduces the need for the utility to transmit power from power plants to the end-use customer, so there may be some benefits in reducing transmission line losses and potentially reducing the need for future transmission and distribution investment. It should be noted here that it is probable that these benefits will vary depending upon the utility and each utility's circumstances, such as the utility's peak power needs or their capacity, sufficiency, deficiency situation, or even their transmission and distribution system situation. And the cost of solar installation can also depend on a number of things. Geographic location is one of them. The PNUC study, for example, says that a particular solar resource in Boise, Idaho, produces 40% more energy per year than a similar system in Seattle. Within Oregon, there is a palpable difference between the solar exposure in the Willamette Valley and east of the east side of the state. Installation size is a significant factor in the cost, with larger installations usually being more efficient, but other variables include the technology and permitting costs, et cetera. So one truism is that solar systems do continue to drop in price. And since 1998, the installed per watt cost of solar PV has come down by almost two-thirds. Since 2010, the per kilowatt hour cost of installed systems has dropped by half, from 40 cents per kilowatt hour to less than 20 cents per kilowatt hour, and even further lower than that for larger solar installations. As you can see, however, that is compared to a 4 cent per kilowatt hour market cost of energy, and then the 10 cents per kilowatt hour, 4 cents per kilowatt hour for on market, and then 10 cents the retail rate. And the costs are generally, this is a very broad statement, generally broken down into two pieces. One is the hardware, including the solar panels themselves. The panel costs have come down significantly over the last several years. And the other cost is the labor cost and installation costs. There are efforts nationally to try to bring focus on reducing the costs of the actual installation.
Madam Chair. Can we ask questions as we go through this, or?
Do you mind saving the questions for the end?
I was just, because they relate to the slides is the only reason I was asking.
I think he only has about three more slides.
Very short. So this is a list of existing policies in the state, the policies and programs, and I think it's going to take, I'm not going to go through them because it would take quite a bit of time, but we'll can happy to talk about them a little bit later. So here's a pro and a con. The pro is having a number of different kinds of policies and different incentive types makes sense because solar is still in a process of maturation. And certainly from many years ago, there were different kinds of barriers, and it was worth testing out different constructs to see what it was that made solar work better. There are still challenges and market barriers to explore and to better understand participant financing. There's an issue of whether or not whether net metering is a cost shift to other customers. We can talk about that a little bit later. And the value of solar in general, these are all things that we're still learning from. So I think part of this list is a factor of the evolution of solar. The con is that some of these policies now may be redundant. Each one comes with its own set of transaction costs for the consumer, for the utility, and for the regulator. The existence of many solar policies may itself be a barrier to customers in terms of confusion, transaction costs, and stability. So the July of 2014 investigation looked at the relative costs of the various programs, and there were a few key takeaways. The first one is that size does matter. Policies that supported larger systems generally resulted in lower levelized cost of energy. There are a number of different programs geared toward residential programs, and there was really not an appreciable difference in the cost of the energy output of those programs. Number three was that among the different programs, depending upon the design, there were different benefits to the participant. But really one of the things that we were looking at is the cost of the incentive really would fall on three groups of folks: the ratepayer of the utility, the participant who had the solar panel on his or her roof, and the taxpayer. And depending upon the type of program and the incentive, that cost was spread out in different ways. So there are some that are much heavier greater cost on the ratepayer, for example, and there are some that were greater cost on the taxpayer. And then finally, we were not really able to say that one policy was more effective in promoting solar than another. It really depends upon what the legislature's goal in and the policy objective is. There's one answer if you're trying to get as much solar energy as you can with the least cost. There's another if you are really trying to incent solar to be as distributed as widely as possible on as many rooftops as you can get. It depends largely on what it is ultimately that the policy goal is. And so finally, the next steps. The commission in the July 24 investigation recommended a couple of things. The first thing is that the PUC committed to opening a docket on the value of solar to try to quantify to the extent possible the value of solar capacity contribution or the value of reducing line losses, et cetera. That is a docket that has begun at the Public Utility Commission. We have a sort of a first phase schedule that consists of a number of workshops to get the stakeholders in a room to begin scoping out what those issues are going to be. And then I think within 4 or 5 months, there is a workshop scheduled with the commissioners themselves to sort of take stock of the direction of that docket. As part of that docket, there's also expressly the commission said it would determine if there was cost shifting from net metering. Net metering, as you'll remember, reduces the amount of energy. If I have solar on my roof, it will net out the amount of energy that I'm buying from the utility. There are fixed costs built into the rate structure, and so there's at least an argument that if I'm net metering, I'm not paying a full share of my fixed costs. There's an argument, I think, that in California, where solar is big and getting bigger, that the cost shift, the contribution to fixed cost issue, will be very significant. It's not clear whether that's going to be true in Oregon with our level of solar installations. And then finally, a PUC workshop to examine the use of smart meters and track national standards. These are ways to ease further development of solar PV into the system. And so with that, I think we are open for questions.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at the one, and I've seen different numbers on this, but you had open market price for power is 4 cents. And solar is 40 cents?
It's in the teens at this point.
So,
then again, it depends upon the size of the installation.
I'm just trying to...
Let me go back there.
I was going with what you had. I have right now, I was here in open market, was 2.5 cents and about 25 cents for solar.
So the second bullet there is it was about 40 cents in 2010. It's now under 20, but that is, so it's in the teens, but that is compared to 4 cents on the market, 4 to 5 cents.
So it's safe to say that, follow up, that what we've done with the tax credits for driving down the cost of solar has done its job and appeared to have worked.
Chair Baker-Peterson, Representative Widener, I don't know that I can say that. Clearly, there are reductions in the cost of the hardware itself. There's reductions in the cost of the installation. On the flip side, again, there are potential values that may or may not be fully considered when we're looking at this kind of a comparison. From a market point of view, it's not. I can't say whether or not that the policies that have been heretofore have done all of their job that they can do. There's probably still room for cost to come down.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jason, thanks for your report. It's really helpful. Could we take a look at net metering just for a minute? What potential adjustments could be considered as a way of, again, tinkering with the formula, tinkering with the reimbursement rates, tinkering with mandating some sort of base payment by every customer? Are those the type of things that the PUC will be considering as you do the work you talked about in your last slide there?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, those are the kinds of things that the commission would be looking at. So that sort of the most obvious one is making the customer charge much bigger and putting a lot of the fixed costs into that customer charge. There's the downside of doing that, which it is a disincentive to do and to be more efficient, to do energy efficiency, because if you before you turn on a light, if you have a $40 customer charge, the value of that kilowatt hour that you're turning on or not turning on is significantly reduced, because your variable cost or your variable charge on each kilowatt hour is going to be much smaller. Mm-hmm. So you now have, in a sense, competing rate design issues. And so that's one of the things I think that the commission is going to look at.
Follow up. It's my understanding, I think the reimbursement rate right now or the retail rate for net metering is it's over 11 cents per kilowatt hour, which obviously compares pretty dramatically with what the 4 cents or even less that's available for the utilities to buy that power out on the open market. So are others, obviously you mentioned California, are you aware of or tracking what other states are doing regarding net metering, and are there other trends that we might learn from as, again, this new industry kind of matures and grows up? Everybody's going to have some of the same growth pains, if you will, and obviously some states that have a much more sunnier exposure will get there much quicker than we probably will. But
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, those are the kinds of things that we will be looking at in the value of solar docket. I mentioned that the schedule for that docket has been set, or at least first phase, mm-hmm. and the first couple of workshops with the parties in the room is going to determine what the scope is going to be, and so that's clearly on the list. And you know, I don't want to guarantee you that mm-hmm. we'll have a full investigation of that, but those issues are clearly front and center.
And how long will this process be?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, that's a good question.
Oh, okay.
What we have is a schedule for first phase, nice. And it's going out 4 or 5 months. And then, depending upon how cooperative the parties are, we hope to get something, 6, 8 months after that.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon.
Follow up on Representative Johnson's question. I had really been looking forward to knowing the value of solar. We talked about that during our workshop 2 years ago. And I thought we'd have that by now, so I'm just disappointed that we don't. Is there some way to kind of compress the schedule? I feel like we're behind.
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, there are a number of jurisdictions, a number of states that are working through the value of solar. We did a brief survey. Rather than doing a full value of solar in this investigation, we did a survey of what some of the other states were looking at in terms of value of solar. And I think it's safe to say that that there is no answer, that the range even within the range of values even within a particular value within a particular state study, there was a range. And when you look at the range of a particular solar value amongst the different state studies, there was a significant range there too. So this is not going to be an exact science.
Right. I understand that. Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation at the solar world, no pun intended there, the solar environment that we live in is certainly a little bit complex. And I'm wondering if, when you're talking about net metering and the cost shift, can you compare that to the volumetric incentive rate, and does that get away from the cost shift, which you're speaking of?
Madam Chair, Representative Holby, there are pros and, like I said, there's sort of pros and cons to each different construct. The argument that net metering has a contribution to fixed cost issue is not present in the residential VIR pilot program. There are different issues, however, in terms of where the burden of the incentive is in those two different programs. So there are pros and cons to each. I think I'll leave it at that if I can.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jason. For me, I think one of the most valuable things was the slide where you talked about all the different solar programs in Oregon, just to have an inventory of that as we're going through this session and talking about potential new programs or new ways of looking or expansions of existing programs is very helpful. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Committee, the PUC report, both of the ones that he referred to are up on OLIS or will be up on OLIS shortly, so you'll have those if you would like to get any further information from those reports. All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the informational meeting on the PUC report and open a public hearing on House Bill, both House Bills 2745 and 2941. And I believe the first person we have up to testify is Senator Breyer. Welcome. And Rep. Holtby, would you like to join him?
Might as well.
All right. Wonderful. Do you want to read the bill? Sure. Beth, why don't you go ahead and read the bill while we're while they're getting settled?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2745 would change the cumulative nameplate capacity of systems enrolled in the pilot solar PV program and extend the pilot program from March 31, 2016 to March 31, 2021. There's no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact. House Bill 2941 would define a community solar garden as a facility that uses solar power to generate electricity for subscriber organizations. There's no revenue impact and maybe a fiscal impact.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, members, I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, which is Central Lane and Linn Counties. Of course, you had to make me happy to testify with Hovey. He always gets me in trouble.
It's my job.
Lane County.
Actually, Representative Hovey and I have worked cooperatively on the idea of promoting community solar, which is your 2941 bill. I have a companion bill in the Senate that does the same thing. I'm not going to go into a great detail today, but I just wanted to encourage your positive consideration of this. Representative Hovey and I have been working on this concept actually for a couple of years. Specifically, and I will tell you that from my perspective, I think we've done a lot of work around renewables over the years, back from the time when I was chairing the PUC. And certainly, I think your room is full of people that are supporting solar today, particularly individual solar. And I don't want to take anything away from that. I think those are good things. But what I am particularly concerned about and interested in is promoting the opportunity for people to participate in what I consider kind of a condominium approach to solar, where you can have a larger installation, professionally managed, and dispatchable by the utilities. That's important. As you can get there, we've talked about it over the years. We really, I don't think, have a perfect way to do that. You hear it referred to as community solar or solar gardens in the bill. Essentially, what you have is what the representative and I stole from Colorado. I mean, they had the proposal there, and literally I think what Paul and I both did was grabbed it and sent it down to LC and said, see if you can fit this into Oregon law. And I think the Legislative Council has done a fairly good job, but it's not perfect. It still needs some work. And where I would like to go with this at this point is take some time and put together a small working group of those most likely to do this, which would include there are just a few companies that would have the financial wherewithal to put one of these together. Currently in Oregon, there may be others, but that's currently practice. The utilities, I think we need to find a way to financially incent the utilities to be in this business. There's nothing wrong with them making money on it. They are private companies. And the experts, particularly the PUC, which will end up having to regulate this if we put it in statute. And I guess there's some others around. The Department of Energy might have an interest in it. They have had in the past. So that's kind of where I'm at, is to encourage you to be positive about this. I think it's a good way to go. It makes sense. It's a little different than where we've gotten to date. In some ways, it's similar to establishing the wind generation units that various companies have done. So that's essentially it. Not a lot of detail. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Paul Holby, State Representative from District 8. And I appreciate Senator Byer's comments. We have talked about this for quite some time and trying to figure out how to establish solar policy in Oregon so we can enable participation in the growing industry of solar technology and adding that into the mix of our energy portfolio as we see the future sort of pointing us towards more renewables. Solar certainly has a lot of advantages. One of the things we've done is, as Senator Byer mentioned, we have, and I think you'll be hearing from somebody from Colorado on the community solar bill. But when we look at solar policy, you know, in Oregon, we have rooftop and we have the discussion of big solar. And, you know, it occurs to us there should be room for all of these sorts of approaches if we had policies that could address, you know, those different types of solar programs. And so initially we were trying to address the piece about community solar. We do have a Dash 1 amendment in this bill, and one of the fundamental differences is that the Dash 1 amendment uses the volumetric incentive rate and as opposed to the incentive or the net metering that's in the original bill. And that kind of comes from the discussion we just had of, you know, what's the right approach and, you know, really wanting to make sure that, you know, the publics, the IOUs and communities can participate in solar really means that we have to, you know, come up with some policies that work for everyone. And that may sound like a wishful thinking, but we do think it's possible for the state of Oregon to move closer to, you know, policy that will help us enable all sorts of solar. And I think the community solar gardens bill really helps people get involved in solar in a different way than just rooftop. And we're hoping that it also gives the opportunity for utilities through the on-bill credit of how they establish, you know, how much value there is to the subscriber organization, that the utilities will be able to participate in, recovering their costs of participating in it. So there's no disincentive for them not to go down this road. And so I agree with Senator Byer. We were hopeful. You know, we had a work group before session started, and we were hoping it would get the conversation going among the stakeholders to really work on putting some of these pieces together. As of yet, those pieces are not quite all together, and we're hoping that with this proposal, and I think you've heard from, our committee's heard from the utility scale solar as well, and not really to, you know, just walk away from rooftop. I think rooftop is viable for a lot of applications and some people as well. But that's sort of where we're at this point. We bring you this community solar garden proposal because I think it's a good piece of work that's based on some systems that are operating in different parts of the country. And it's, I think, a very good step towards Oregon looking at community solar gardens, and commend it to the committee to work on, and the work group hopefully to work out some of the details of how it works for the IOUs, how it might work for co-ops, though co-ops aren't really required. This bill doesn't really apply to them, but they have a lot of interest in this issue as well, and I believe do want to participate in solar around the state to serve Oregonians across the whole state. So that's sort of our goal, and well, I know there's a lot of other people here to testify on the specifics of the bill, more than we can probably address, but we're happy to answer some of those unspecific questions you might have. Mm-hmm.
Thank you
for the
questions. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, Representative, I mean, I kind of like the concept, a little bit of where you're going here, because I've kind of thought, you know, people who want to be independent and off the grid, this is where you could actually do housing developments, where you actually just power that development off solar and then have power brought in beside that. But the one concern I have with solar is the amount of real estate it takes up to power homes. So for a family of four and things like that, especially here on this side of the mountain range where we have a lot of valuable farmland. So I hope that's something in your work group that you kind of take into consideration, because I'm seeing farm ground where they're putting solar panels all across it, where before there were crops growing in some of those. So as you're doing this, I don't know if that's one of the things that's ever came up or you've thought about, but hope it's one of the things that you consider and making these independent communities and not relying on the big utilities to carry the power form, but keep everything centrally localized for these communities and solar gardens. So.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener, that is an issue. They take a lot of room. I mean, if you're going to do it, I think the average for solar is somewhere between 5 and 7 acres per megawatt. So, you know, they do take some room. But there is the potential. I think the ones we're likely to see in a community solar, if ever to happen, are probably more in the 500 kilowatt to maximum, I would say, 2 megawatt. In fact, I think that's in the bill,
yes.
Size that you would look at there. And there's the opportunities, you know, if you were doing it. In the ideal world, you would find, you know, in say out by the airport in Portland, there's a couple out there, you would be covering the rooftops with that, connecting them together. That makes it more likely to do that. You get some real economies of scale if you're doing a little bigger, you know, less inverters and all of that sort of thing, which runs the cost up, so your cost to get there is cheaper. The other thing that I think is an important feature is that a lot of people who would like to have solar, even on the roof, may not have the right facing rooftop. And they may be living in an apartment or be a renter. This would allow them, could allow them, I should say, an ability to buy into it and buy in a unit much as you would. I like the model that makes the most sense to me as I think about it is a real estate condominium model where you actually have an ownership stake and you have a homeowners association, you will have someone to manage it so you know it's taken care of. My primary concern about individual systems is I really worry that they won't be adequately managed over time. Now, some people will do a very good job, others will not, and the efficiency will go down. So you have that. And the third piece is you need a system that integrates into the utility-wide system so they can manage it. They're having some pretty significant problems in Southern California with that, trying to manage the systems together. And I think we have an opportunity to get ahead of the game and get the best of all possible worlds. So this is just one small piece of that.
And Senator Beyer is correct. It's 2 megawatts or less for to qualify as a community solar garden.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, for those who feel the need to or want to feel like they are, in fact, investing in renewables and have their investments go towards that, you know, Pacific Corp or Pacific Power has the Blue Sky program where you can pay more on your bill if you want to, and then theoretically that goes for investments that the utility makes in potentially stuff like solar and or wind or whatever. So you're saying we need to provide something that's more substantive or more tangible, or I'm just trying to find out how what you're proposing is a better alternative than that, and then let the utility decide what would be the most efficient way to invest in those renewables rather than have a patchwork of various alternatives or, you know, renewables out there.
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I think it could be part of that as well. It's just a different way of getting there. In the Blue Sky program, you're sort of buying in, saying for however whatever block I'm buying, I want you to sell me this, and the rate is just higher, mm-hmm. whatever it is there. With this thing, you really would own, if you will, a piece of the rock, you know, and you would trade off kilowatt for kilowatt in some billing fashion, you know. And I could think of different ways to do that, but that's partially what I would suggest we need a work group to get all the players comfortable with an approach.
Thank you both very much for your time, and I support the idea of having a work group on this, so I look forward to putting that together with you. So thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, next I'm going to call up Representative Reed, who is here to talk about House Bill 2745. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I am glad to follow Representative Hovey and Senator Beyer. And I simply want to echo a lot of what I heard them say about the need for a comprehensive approach to solar. I'm here because of the experience I had in 2009 around House Bill 3039, which established the pilot program around a feed-in tariff. I think you'll probably hear from others with more detail and precision about that experience, but I think it's a generally good thing that gave us the chance to experiment, that gave us the chance to adjust in a flexible way with the PUC's expert help, and to jumpstart a lot of development around solar power and installed capacity. The bill that I introduced, 2745, was simply intended to give us a chance to consider whether that pilot project ought to continue and in what form, perhaps at a higher capacity, perhaps with a different emphasis around larger scale projects. I think one of the things we did in the initial version was to emphasize small scale residential installations, and my rather primitive assessment is that we may have moved past that and be able to move the ball or the needle, insert your preferred image, a little bit more with an increased emphasis on larger scale projects. So I think there's lots to talk about, lots of good things in this bill and in the others that are before you. And I was glad to hear the chair talk about the need for a work group that could try to integrate all of these opportunities and concerns. I'm happy to explain any more about the bill that you might be interested in, but I recognize you've got a full agenda, so I appreciate hearing the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Reed? Get off easy. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you.
All right. We have a lot of people signed up to give testimony today. So first, I'd like to call up Mark Pengilly, Kathleen Newman, and Paul Israel. Welcome. Please go ahead and whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Pengilly. I'm here today representing Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress. Our mission is to advance the transition to locally generated renewable energy as rapidly as we possibly can. There has been a lot of discussion lately about the transition from fossil fuel-fired generation to renewable generation. It's a transition that we recognize is in our best interest, both economically and environmentally. The concept is appealing, but we need to solve the puzzle of the tools for the transition to a clean energy economy. The feed-in tariff program, or VIR pilot, VIR standing for volumetric incentive rates, is one of those tools. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the pilot program and where it can lead. The first thing I would tell you about the solar pilot program is that it is a successful, proven program. It works. In 4 years, it's responsible for 25% of all the installed solar in the state. Two-thirds of all the solar placed on public schools and universities in Oregon was installed through the solar pilot program. It does not use tax credits or general fund dollars. And because of this, it can be used by individuals without a tax liability, by nonprofits, and by local governments. There have been no cost overruns or hidden costs. The program is on track to produce its 27.5 megawatts of power at the projected rate impact of 0.25%. A feed-in tariff system places no risk on taxpayers or ratepayers. It pays only for the electricity generated as it is generated. There's no upfront money paid. If the solar array is shaded, or it's not maintained, or it fails to perform as expected, the risk is on the owner of the system, not the taxpayer or the ratepayer. Program capacity is allocated in tranches with payments that decline with each successive offering, so the price is continuously being driven down. Participants apply for capacity for a solar system. They use their own funds to get a loan or get a loan to build a solar system. Then they sign a contract with their utility to sell the power they generate at a fixed rate over the life of the contract. Smaller systems receive standard offer contracts. The rate is published by the PUC, and they're paid that rate. For larger systems, a reverse auction mechanism is used. Applicants submit a bid to produce power for a competitive rate, and the lowest bid wins capacity. At the end of the contract, when the system is paid for, the rate paid is reduced to the resource value at that time. Here is what the PUC said in its January 2015 report to the legislature, that there was no fundamental difference in system costs, with the exception that the reverse auction mechanism for large systems under the VIR pilot has consistently provided the lowest energy and installation costs among the programs. This is a program that merits being continued. This has been a pilot, one that is scheduled to end in 2016. Its remaining capacity will be allocated this year. What House Bill 2745 does is to simply extend the life of the pilot program from 2016 to 2021. It does not specify program capacity. A pilot program is supposed to provide lessons. Here are some of the lessons that we've learned from the pilot. It's popular. The conventional wisdom was that Oregonians would not put up their own money for a long-term payback. The first allocation in 2010 sold out in 11 minutes. The second larger allocation sold out in 8 minutes. The second thing we've learned is that there was never adequate capacity in the program for commercial scale projects. The original program capacity was only 25 megawatts, 75% of which was reserved for residential and small commercial systems. As a result, first-come, first-served competition for allocation was fierce, and many people did not get the capacity that they had applied for. The application system then went to a lottery basis, but this meant that many developers had to bear the expense of acquiring customers, designing systems, and preparing multiple bids
with no assurance that they would be awarded capacity and be able to build a project. Without adequate program capacity, and in the aftermath of the tax credit program for businesses, commercial installation in Oregon basically tanked. We think there are more lessons to be learned and cost savings to be achieved as we focus on commercial and community systems. Thirdly, as you've heard, costs and rates have declined. For example, rates for medium-scale systems dropped from a high of 55 cents a kilowatt hour in 2010 to 16 cents a kilowatt hour in April 2014, a 70% decrease in the rates. We feel strongly that the program merits being continued, but we have had discussions about amendments to the bill that would make it more cost-effective by taking advantage of the economies of scale of larger projects, as you've heard other speakers mention, and would put up more clean solar faster. So perhaps this gets to Representative Widener's point. I'm sorry he's going to miss it, but how big is 100 kilowatts? These are examples of larger system sizes. What we're talking about as we increase the average system size of this program, we would like to see the bulk of the extended program be dedicated to larger systems and increase the maximum system size in this program from 500 kilowatts up to 2 megawatts. You've heard testimony in House Bill 2632, the utility scale bill that would include systems from 2 megawatts up to 45 megawatts. David Brown testified that his proposal works down to about a size of 2 megawatts. But as Representative Reed mentioned, we need a comprehensive program. We need a diverse mix of distributed generation, different pieces of the puzzle that fit together. So we have the RETC and the Energy Trust incentives that address the smaller residential rooftop systems, typically up to about 7 kilowatts. We'd like to see the extended program serve the piece of the puzzle between the rooftop systems and the utility scale systems. This would allow commercial and community systems to be located on rooftops of Fred Meyer's, grocery stores, warehouses, and larger ground-mounted systems located close to load where new transmission is not required. Transmission is an issue with utility scale, and so is that slide being out of place. But what this shows you is an IKEA roof with a quite large commercial or community scale project on it. This slide is from the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, which is currently preparing its seventh plan. If you'll notice that the left-hand arrow has a cost estimate for utility-scale solar in southern Idaho of just under $100 a megawatt hour. The right-hand column and right-hand arrow has the same system located not near transmission in southern Idaho. Where new transmission is required, there's about a 4 cent per kilowatt hour add for new transmission. What this tells us is that as part of our system, we need larger community scale systems that are located close to load that don't require additional transmission. As you've heard, many of us do not own a sunny south or west facing roof, and we can't afford to put a system on our own roof, perhaps. And we support the concept of community solar, which allows people that don't have this roof, type of roof of their own, or capital, to pool their investments and invest in a larger, more economically efficient project. Last year, you passed Senate Bill 1520, which facilitated forming community renewable energy cooperatives. These cooperatives need a simple way to sell their power. There are now 14 community renewable energy co-ops in various stages of discussion in Roseburg, Medford, Corvallis, Philomath, Portland, Milwaukee, and some irrigation districts in southern Oregon. The Community Solar Gardens Bill is another example of shared ownership, but this VIR program, the pilot, is an ideal way to allow owners of various types of systems to sell the power that they generate. In order to serve these community scale and commercial systems, the program needs more capacity. The original program had a rate impact limit of 0.25%, or about 25 cents on a typical monthly residential bill. The rate impact and the program capacity need to be increased now so that more significant, cost-effective solar systems can be installed quickly and widely. On this point, despite the program's popularity and successes, it has had its critics, which claim it's too expensive. I think a rate impact reality check is in order. Solar is no longer expensive. It's competitive with utility-scale wind and gas. By way of comparison, the Carty Generating Plant, which is being built on the Boardman site, will have a 4.7% rate impact when it is placed in service. Boy, next year. There it is. This is compared to, remember, a 0.25% rate impact. We've all just gotten a reduction of about $1.50 a gallon on our gasoline. For the savings of the price of 1 gallon of gasoline a month, for $1.50 a month on a residential bill, we could install 250 megawatts of clean solar generating capacity. This seems like a bargain. With a larger program, our analysis is that the average program cost would decline to about 14 cents a kilowatt hour. The last winning bid in the pilot program for a 500 kilowatt project was under 11 cents a kilowatt hour, about what our residential rate is. We expect an incremental decreases in cost going forward. We need these tools and we need this program. This is a Pacific Coast slide. And if you look at the green bar, that's renewables. This runs from 2014 out to 2032. And while we see that the blue coal is declining and the red natural gas is increasing in the generation mix, there is essentially zero increase in renewables going all the way out to 2030. So we need more models to help us get there.
Mr. Pengilly, we have a full room, so if you could wrap up. I want to make sure we have time to get to everyone today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll try to wrap up quickly. We should be investing in solar now to take advantage of these cost trends. I do want to show you a slide that many people find surprising. This shows what percentage of solar we currently have in our Oregon electricity consumption. People have asked, why solar? Why not other resources? Solar pales in comparison to these other resources. And to put a finer point on it, if you look very hard here in the left-hand slide, you can see what might be a little red on top of the right-hand column in 2012, or it might not be. The point is that we have about 0.2% of our electricity consumption in Oregon is solar. We have lots of room to grow before we get a balance with any of the other renewable resources. I was going to speak to you about some of the benefits of disaster resiliency. I know that that has been covered in some other written testimony that's been submitted. I'll leave you with this. The mantra for renewable energy policy is transparency, longevity, and certainty. Feed-in tariff program is transparent. It lists the rates. They're published. You can see what's going on. Longevity, I would submit, is longer than 5 years and stop. We're still learning how to make this program more effective. We're still in a maturation phase, and certainty is important so that developers and the supply chain and investors and lenders can plan ahead. If we continue this program, we have TLC and the program can move ahead. This won't cause a quantum leap in research and development. It's too small. It would only increase solar from 0.2% to a little over 0.5%, but it's a prudent, proven building block, and it won't be a big mistake either. It's a measured, effective program that will move us a few steps down the road. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Kathleen Newman, and I think in the interests of honoring other people's time, you have my written testimony about the importance of diversifying our energy mix, particularly in light of our shift of stream flow towards the winter. Check out the Northwest Power and Conservation Council slide there showing the trough in our energy production going forward from hydro in June, July, August, and September. That gap can be very, very well filled with solar. Again, wanted to talk a little bit about disaster resiliency of having solar on community buildings where we can, with new inverters, have power during the day. And I think I'll leave it at that and let you read my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Paul Israel, president of OSEA, representative Vega Peterson, chair. Thank you very much. And I think I'll wait for the slides to come on up.
Yeah, can you go ahead and get started with some of your we do have a lot of people signed
sure.
up. Thank you.
Again, Paul Israel, president of OSEA. I want to talk a little bit about the feed-in tariff and the success it's had on the industry. Slides that will come up will show that the feed-in tariff, according to a 2012 OSEA poll, about 87% of all OSEA members participated in the feed-in tariff, which was quite substantive. And also, as a percentage of revenues for those solar companies that really worked in the feed-in tariff, about 48% of the revenue on average was generated from the feed-in tariff program. As far as rural Oregonians found on ranchers, a Pacific Power report showed us that approximately 20% of the residential small-scale capacity was used by ranchers and farmers. So when I talk about the small scale, here we go. Thank you. So, of course, we want to talk about the feed-in tariff and the importance of it to OSEA and to Oregonians. According to that poll, I want to go back over that quickly. 89% of OSEA contractors used the FIT, and those identified that used it said it was 48% of their revenue, so it's an important driver for the industry. Of course, Mark talked a little bit about 24% of the feed-in tariff, or Oregon Solar, was from the feed-in tariff. And here we talk about Pacific Power. It's an interesting slide. This is the small-scale solar, and we drill down at Pacific Power. It's interesting that 20% of the capacity in Pacific Core was used by irrigators. So it's interesting to find out folks were trying to cut their electric bills on farming in rural ranches. Of course, and a lot of the small and medium FIT users use SolarWorld modules. Very important. SolarWorld is such a driver to the Oregon economy and to expand manufacturing jobs. And, of course, the OSEA and the solar industry is large and small. We have large installers like EC Electrical Construction Company, Christensen Electric. We have installers in all corners of Oregon. We have Echo Solar down at Klamath Falls, Medford, Oregon. Any small electrical contractor is a solar contractor. Educational institutions, LCC, Klamath Community College, OSU Cascades. We have an intern from OSU Cascades. Why is solar good public policy? Customers will pay more for solar. Customers want a diverse mix of energy. And if you've seen from the PUC report on the feed-in tariff, solar is affordable. Customers will pay a little bit more for solar, as we've seen from some PGE studies. And customers want a diverse portfolio of their energy. It's like retirement. You want to diversify. We have a lot of folks in Central Oregon who come in who are retired and want to cut their energy bill or at least be able to hedge that. So thoughts to leave you with, let's put the power into the hands of Oregonians, all Oregonians. So put a smile on their faces, money in their places, and we believe the FIT really achieves that goal. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Weirden.
Mr. Israel, just on a typical installation, can you give me some idea how long it takes to repay that?
Sure. On whether it's Energy Trust of Oregon or the feed-in tariff, whether it's a rebate route or the feed-in tariff route, we see typical paybacks anywhere from 6 to 10 years.
Cool. Thank you.
Representative Weidner.
Thank you. Madam Chair. Just a question just to follow up on what Representative Reardon was saying. What's the life cycle of a solar system on one like you're doing?
Sure. Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Weiner. Life cycle, as far as we know, the design life for a solar electric system is about 45 years. Typical warranties for solar electric panels, 25 years. And that guarantees that 80% of that production is still there in year 25. A lot of us will be pushing daisies, and these things will still be pushing electrons.
Okay. Thank you all very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call up Shane Kimball, James Cook, and Dan Orzik.
Thank you all for this opportunity. I'm James Cook. I'm a retired U.S. Postal Service letter carrier and currently an active member of the American Federation of Musicians, Local 99. I'm very grateful and honored to be here today to sing the praises of solar power and to deliver our enthusiastic support as a union for HB 2745 and HB 2941. During the summer of 2014, the Musicians Hall in Portland became an electricity generating facility. And that this environmentally and socially responsible action was made possible by the Oregon feed-in tariff. Otherwise, it would not have been financially feasible. Without the feed-in tariff program, the cost savings payback time would have taken too long, if ever, given the limited lifespan of some solar panels. The Musicians Union officers and membership could only justify the expenditure of our membership dues because of the feed-in tariff program. We urge continuation and support these bills under your consideration. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Hello, my name is Shane Kimball. I live in Eastern Oregon, and I have a company called Solar Surfers because we're riding the wave of the future. And about 5 years ago, I was a school teacher in Adrian, Oregon, and I bailed ship because the economy was bad, and I became a solar contractor. And I think it's probably one of the best moves I ever made. I've been installing solar for 5 years now. I live in Joseph, Oregon as well. I have a business also in Malheur County in Nissa, where Idaho Power is, and that's where I started. And I started right when the feed-in tariff was paying 55 cents per kilowatt hour. And, of course, now it's down to, like, 23, and there's some leftovers in Pacific Power territory. Basically, thanks to the solar pilot program, which is 90% of my business. I heard a gentleman say it was like 40% or whatever. But in Eastern Oregon, you have to realize, in Idaho Power territory, we are not part of Oregon Energy Trust. Okay, so there is no other rebate except for the federal tax credit. So when the feed-in tariff first came out, it was the only thing really that we had. And I've employed dozens of people over the last couple of years. Many of those people are college fraternity brothers of mine, and you name it. I mean, we've got a diversity of different people from the community that I've employed. I think we started off at about $6 a watt, and now we do ground mounts out in Eastern Oregon mostly. There really isn't a lot of roof space, and most of the clients and stuff that I have are farmers and ranchers, and we're trying to power center pivots and irrigation lines and barns and things like that. And we started off about $6 a watt, and now we're down about $4.50, and that's not with any Oregon Energy Trust rebate. I'd say that, I mentioned I employed dozens of people in the last 5 years, and all of them have been dedicated to the growth of this new and exciting industry, and I wanted to say that they want to stay in the game. And I want to keep being able to pay my employees. So I think in connection, it's been the most rewarding job I think I've ever had. I really feel like I've had a chance kind of at the American dream. Plus, you can't help but feel good about helping people in your local community become more energy independent. Our clients are smart, progressive, and financially educated folks who know that the feed-in tariff will allow them to cash flow their investment while being good stewards of the land. And if you know anything about cash flow, there's a great kids game out there called Cash Flow. And I think that's the key here with the feed-in tariff, because when you really pencil it out, it if you borrow the money, you got to be able to pay back that loan. And the feed-in tariff has allowed that. So most of the farmers and ranchers, let's see, how are with the program? Sorry, this is the first time I've ever done this. I'm a little nervous. It's true, 90% of my business has been from the feed-in tariff program. However, Idaho Power offered the last feed-in tariff round last year and are gladly done with it. As a matter of fact, Idaho Power is currently trying to convince Idaho PUC that all PURPA contracts should be only 2 years instead of 20, which spells death, you know, basically to anybody trying to put a solar farm in the state of Idaho right now and possibly even eastern Oregon. What this comes down to is that I just basically lost 90% of my business in Mallard County. However, I saw this coming, and so I moved to Ulao County and moved to Joseph, and I'm buying a house in Joseph right now as we speak. Pacific Power's territory last year, we took advantage of that, but basically May is going to be the last round. There's some scraps left over. So we're down to 23 cents, which is barely able to do it. It barely pencils out. So I feel like my company will probably sink if this program's pulled. The feed-in tariff allows people to cash flow their investment, but without it, they can't. People need a reasonable return on their investment to make solar work for them, and please pass House Bill 2745. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Orzek. I'm a solar developer from Corvallis. I'm also on the board of OREP, Oregonians for Renewable Energy Progress. Last year, the legislature passed SB 1520, which enables renewable energy cooperatives in the state. I'm now in the process of launching a co-op to do solar projects, and I'm very pleased to tell you that there's a tremendous amount of interest in the co-op model for community solar projects. Renewable energy cooperatives are the mechanism for allowing Oregon citizens to invest in solar projects in their community. But the co-op does not change the fundamental economics of solar. To make co-op projects work, support such as the feed-in tariff that 2745 would continue is necessary. The feed-in tariff has been particularly effective in enabling Oregon schools to install solar, as we heard previously. Two-thirds of solar panels in Oregon schools and universities were installed with the help of the feed-in tariff. I am talking with a number of schools which are very interested in using the co-op model to install solar. I urge you to support HB 2745 to allow the renewable energy cooperatives to reach their full potential of putting solar on the roofs of Oregon schools and other community institutions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'm going to call up Ricky Segman, Tom Hunt, and Andrea Jacobs.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ricky Segwin, and I work as the lead advocate with Environment Oregon. Environment Oregon is a statewide, citizen-based environmental advocacy organization, and I'm here representing our over 40,000 members and supporters across the state in support of both bills that we're hearing today, HB 2745 and HB 2941. I think it's important to mention that these two bills fit together quite well in this sort of overall solar landscape that we're looking at here in Oregon. You've already heard previously about a bill that focuses on the large utility scale solar, and Mark mentioned this in his comments before, but it's important that we're not leaving the residential rooftop market out of the picture, but are focusing on where we have the biggest hole right now, which is this sort of commercial scale market in Oregon, which is left with very few programs, if any, to support it. By extending the feed-in tariff, which we know has been proven to be very successful in installing solar across the state. We're getting at both the small-scale solar and the commercial, really the commercial-scale market that's been missing the help and the support that it needs. The Community Solar Gardens Bill is also essential for getting at that missing hole right there in the middle with the commercial-size, commercial-scale solar. And I want to go back to just the overall picture of how solar fits in with our electricity mix in the state. I can't stress enough that 0.02% solar is a very, very, very small number when you look across the country, or if you're doing my job, you're talking to our members all across the state. People think we're close to 10%, right? I mean, people think we're Oregon, we're this green, clean energy leader. 0.02% of our electricity coming from solar is woefully behind where we could and should be if we put policies in place that were consistent and driving forward and forward thinking. We know how popular clean energy is. A recent Winston Group poll showed that 82% of Oregonians are favorable of renewable energy. But to just dig in more deeply with solar, we at Environment Oregon chose to get involved on issues around clean energy and solar in particular, because for years we've been hearing from our members across the state, what more can we do? What are the bills that are being passed in other places, other states, that would actually make solar pencil out for me as a homeowner or as a business owner in Oregon? So I just want to highlight some numbers. Environment Oregon right now is knocking on over 10,000 doors across the state, starting in January, going until May. Educating Oregonians about these two solar bills, as well as others that are coming up in the committee. Since January, we've already had nearly 3,000 Oregonians submit public comments in support of these bills. Over 30 businesses who have now endorsed the campaign, these solar bills in particular. I'll point out some highlights being Tofurky, based in Hood River, and Keen Footwear, based in Northwest Portland. We have 29 endorsements from mayors, city councilors, and county commissioners all across the state, including in Eugene, Astoria, Roseburg, Lane County, and Hood River County. And to get to your question from before, Representative Widener, we know that farmers and agriculture, it's a pretty big section of the market here for solar, and are getting endorsements from farmers. So far, about 20 endorsements from farmers statewide, including outside of Astoria and Roseburg. So, we know that there's a hole when it comes to clean energy here in Oregon. The place where we have the largest to grow is solar, clean solar power. Know that you have the public behind you. There is enormous public support for really zeroing in and expanding our solar market. And I urge you to support both HB 2745 and HB 2941 as just two key steps Oregon should take toward repowering with clean energy that doesn't pollute, never runs out, and is putting Oregonians to work. Thank you.
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Jacob, and I'm here representing the City of Portland in support of HB 2941. Portland has had renewable energy policies on the books since the 1970s. Our current climate action plan calls for a reduction of 80% in community-wide carbon emissions by the year 2050, and it establishes aggressive targets for installed solar capacity. Since 2006, Portland has made great strides in increasing solar adoption. There are now approximately 15 megawatts of installed PV capacity in Portland, and we expect and intend to double that by 2019. As our solar programs have matured, we've sought to find ways to make solar more accessible to a wider range of Portlanders. Our highly successful Solarize programs, which you may have heard of, brought solar to hundreds of residents, but mostly upper and middle income homeowners. Applying an equity lens to the city's energy programs led Portland to pursue the development of community shared solar electric systems. We began a serious exploration of community solar in 2011, and we've undertaken two separate pilots between 2012 and 2014. These pilots had limited success in terms of installed solar, but delivered valuable lessons. And I'd say that the key takeaway from these pilots is that community solar requires a much more supportive legislative, regulatory, and financial environment, which you've heard from pretty much everybody else here. The absence of mechanisms to offer customers an on-bill credit, the presence of restrictive securities laws, this was before SB 1520, and the cost and complexity of third-party tax equity financing for solar pose major obstacles to the development of our community shared solar projects. Utility cooperation is essential to successful community shared solar programs. Utility support has been an important factor in every market in which community shared solar programs are more developed than here in Oregon. We see HB 2941 as a critical piece of enabling legislation that sends a signal to the market that Oregon supports community shared solar project and program development. It significantly strengthens the value proposition for consumers to participate in these projects, and it provides utilities with a flexible framework within which to operate. The City of Portland endorses HB 2941 and urges your support. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Hunt. I'm the Vice President of Corporate Development for Clean Energy Collective, or CEC. We're the nation's leading developer of community solar gardens, community solar projects. And from that perspective, I want to touch on three things that I think are important to remember in terms of how this really is going to benefit Oregon in the long run. The first one is that community solar is a proven model that works and can be made specifically to work in Oregon. The second one is the benefits of community solar are real and they're significant. And the third one is that community solar provides customers, provides individuals and small businesses with what they want. You're answering a need here. And so I'll touch on the three of those briefly. The first one, in terms of being a proven model that works, I can speak from our experience. We've built 50 of these projects with 18 different utilities in a wide variety of geographies and regulatory models and markets. This is something that can be made to work anywhere with any details, with the point being that it serves all customers. You have 75 to 80% of residential customers and more business customers that aren't able to do solar on their roof. And as Representative Holvey and Senator Beyer talked about earlier, community solar is perhaps the most proven mechanism to make that open to them. The key thing is that they get to buy panels in these arrays that can be built on land that's polluted or is unusable for other reasons. It can be built in an area that's perfectly sited for the grid. They're maintained for grid reliability, and people can then receive the benefits after buying into it via on-bill credits. And the effort that Representative Holvey has led and is continuing to lead, I think, does that in a very good way for Oregon. The second one is that the benefits of community solar are real and significant. Again, speaking from experience here, each 1 megawatt project we build is a $3 million investment in a community. And because these are community projects that are built throughout the state in local areas where they serve customers, that's investment in multiple communities across the state. And it's not only the construction investment, it's the long-term return on these projects. The bill credits stay in the pockets of people that buy into them, so it stays in the pockets of people there. Over a 30-year lifetime, that could be $20 million of energy payments that stay within a community because it's being generated there and goes back to the people that live there. The third thing I wanted to say is that it provides consumers with what they want. And you're hearing multiple times, from Ricky and the survey they're hearing and others, that people want access to renewable energy. And more so even than that, they want to have control of their energy future. And community solar provides that for them. By passing House Bill 2941, you're going to be opening up an innovative new program that answers a desire from a vast array of Oregonians. I'm happy to answer any questions as well, but otherwise, certainly urge you to support House Bill 2941. And as well as the other bills you're hearing here, I think one of the innovative ways that they're doing this is tying this in with the VIR bill as well. Thank
you. Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all very much for your testimony. Next, I'm going to go ahead and call up Elizabeth Howe, Varner Seaman, and Roxanne Ross. Roxanne Ross.
Okay, Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. I'm here today representing Portland General Electric. I want to talk about a little bit about both 2745 and then 2941. Take those in order. So HB 2745, first I want to talk a little bit about PGE's role in terms of renewable energy. I won't belabor it because I've belabored it in the past in front of this committee. Portland General Electric, as you know, has been a strong supporter of the renewable portfolio standard over the years and a strong supporter of deploying different types of renewable energy. The one thing I haven't talked about in front of this committee yet this year is that just in the last couple weeks we had an announcement that outside of the feed-in tariff, Portland General Electric is putting solar on 6 schools in Portland Public Schools that we're going to be rolling out, and they should be up and delivering power by the beginning of the next school year.
As we look at the feed-in tariff pilot project that's up for consideration under this bill for extending both the capacity and the program as a whole, we want to remind the committee that this was a pilot project, that it was looking at some different ways to incentivize solar. And by our estimation, the pilot project has run its course. It's met the goals that it was needed to that it set out, and that now is the time to let this program sunset and shift to the other incentive programs that we have for solar. One of the things that I think is the most important for us to consider as a utility in the state, and I think that's important for you to consider as legislators, thinking about the totality of the cost implications of some of these programs, is what the cost of the feed-in tariff is in particular. I would ask you to spend some time looking at the report that Jason Eisdorfer went through earlier, and in particular to look at the costs and the tables in the report on what the payments are for the feed-in tariff. For the small-scale installations, for people who came in the first tranche, who are PGE customers, for 15 years, we're going to be paying $650 a megawatt hour, or 65 cents for folks who are participating in that first tranche of it. At the end of the program, in the beginning of 2014, the last series that was subscribed for Portland General Electric's service territory, the price was 39 cents a kilowatt hour, or $390 a megawatt hour. When we compare this to the cost that we would see in the bill that you heard before, HB 2632, those costs are a fraction of what we see in terms of the cost of doing rooftop installations under the feed-in tariff. And we actually, when we look at it, it's more expensive than the net metered policies, which are still in place, which would apply to and provide an incentive for rooftop solar in the state. I think that, and I just have to address one statement that Mr. Pingilly made earlier, comparing the feed-in tariff and the rate impact of the feed-in tariff to the new Cardi generating station, which is being proposed, that's a subject of a current rate case that PGE has. And Mr. Pingilly said that there's a cap on the feed-in tariff program in terms of the rate impact. When you look at the report, the rate impact for Portland General Electric was 0.28% of our overall revenue requirement. The Cardi generating station is 4.7% proposed, beginning part of a rate case. That number probably comes down. If we actually round that number up to 5%, and we look at the capacity of a 440 megawatt gas dispatchable plant, per percentage of rate increase, we're getting 80 megawatts of dispatchable power in the Cardi generating station, compared to, under the feed-in tariff, 2 megawatts of non-dispatchable power. So 2 megawatts compared to 80 megawatts is a tremendous difference. As we look at this program, for all of the renewable acquisition programs we look at, the feed-in tariff program, notwithstanding the comments that folks have made earlier, is a very expensive program for ratepayers. And 100% of the cost is borne by ratepayers of this program. Unlike some of the other programs that we have, such as net metering, which is a shared payment between the state, money is collected from ratepayers through the Energy Trust, and then straight up in rates. As we look at this program, the rate and the cost implications of it, we think going forward, continue to be pretty significant, and we don't think that this is the best way to go forward. I've testified in front of this committee already a couple times this year, supportive of a couple of different solar programs you're looking at or that are under consideration. We do think that solar makes sense. We just think that this is a very expensive way to go forward with solar. The other point I want to make on it, and this is my last point on the feed-in tariff, is that this is only a program right now for the investor-owned utilities. It's not a statewide program. If, in your judgment, you determine that this is an appropriate way to incentivize solar and to deploy solar for the state, we would encourage you to make it. If you saw it, you know, notwithstanding the cost arguments I'm making now, if you think it's a good program for investor-owned utilities, I would encourage you to make it a statewide program. So that's it on 2745. let Elizabeth talk and then come back.
Are you going to speak on both bills or just one?
Yes.
Go ahead and speak on both bills.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on 2941, looking at community solar, we're encouraged by Senator Byer's comments earlier. We understand he's putting together a work group. We're happy and willing to participate in that work group and to look at what may make sense for community solar. We have a pilot program that we're putting forward called the Solar Shares Program, which is a voluntary program that we're working currently through the Public Utilities Commission. It's a way that we take a solar project that we buy the output from, and then we market the above market cost to customers of ours who are interested in participating in a solar program. Mm-hmm. We think that could be one model. We think there are some other models out there. There's one part of HB 2941 that I want to highlight for you that is something that's a particular concern to us. We think that community solar generally can make sense. There are a lot of different definitions that community solar can have in terms of what the actual program design is. There's one component of it that causes quite a bit of heartburn, and that is the component that is sometimes called virtual net metering. In net metering, the way that net metering works is, suppose this table is my house, and I've got a meter that connects my house to the rest of the grid. Now, behind that meter, if I put solar panels on my roof, I'm offsetting the amount of generation I need to take from the grid. One of the reasons why net metering is compensated at the retail rate, one of the arguments for net metering is to say that because you've got this generation occurring behind the meter, on top of the house or on the farm or on the ranch, you're offsetting the need for additional generation to be built. You're also offsetting the need to build additional distribution lines and additional transmission lines. So that's net metering. Under virtual net metering, as we read this bill, you could have a person who lives in Gresham subscribe to a facility which is located in Hillsboro. When the power is generated in Hillsboro, it's transmitted up onto the distribution system, over the transmission lines, back down the distribution system into someone's house. As I look at the notion that under net metering, you don't have additional investments required and you're lessening the burden on the distribution and transmission system, I just don't believe with a straight face you can make the same argument for a facility that could be located in a neighboring county some significant distance away. So to me, that just doesn't pass kind of the straight face kind of nod test in terms of how that policy should be designed. And under this bill, it would have us compensate folks who are doing virtual net metering the exact same way as somebody who's doing net metering behind the meter on their house. That's a point for Portland General Electric that we don't think makes sense to go forward with community solar. Again, we do think community solar makes sense. We think there are ways to design products that would meet the consumer expectation, but that design for us is something that we see is terribly problematic. With that, I'll end my comments. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I represent Pacific Power. And Pacific Power is an investor-owned utility covering six states, but in Oregon, we serve approximately 560,000 customers, largely in rural Oregon. PacifiCorp, like PGE, has invested in renewables quite a bit. Over the last 15 years, PacifiCorp has built and owns 1,800 megawatts of wind, built a 2-megawatt solar facility just outside of Lakeview, Oregon. And renewables make up more than 20% of our owned resources. Additionally, PacifiCorp's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway Energy, is a leader in renewables. From a standing start 10 years ago, BHE now accounts for 6% of the country's wind generation capacity and 7% of the country's solar generation capacity. PacifiCorp has concerns over extending the feed-in tariff pilot as proposed in House Bill 2745, largely because it is a very expensive way to encourage the development of solar. I'll review some numbers over some of the other programs that are in our other states. The Utah Solar Incentive Program is a rebate-style incentive, like kind of like our energy trust incentive. With 60 megawatts installed, it's been about 933,000 per installed megawatt. In California, the incentive program, we've installed 3.5 megawatts at 1.2 million per installed megawatt. Oregon solar incentive program has resulted in 10.9 megawatts installed. That's 6.3 million per installed megawatt, five times more expensive than the program we participate in Utah. And also, we estimate that a utility could build utility-scale solar for about $3.5 million per installed megawatt in Oregon. So the costs are obviously of great concern to us. Additionally, we have some concerns about consumer protection for our customers, particularly when they use third parties. 34% of our customers participating in the feed-in tariff have assigned their payments to a third-party owner. So the profit or incentive payment that these systems receive over the contract is not received by the customer, but by a third party. So we've heard anecdotal stories from our customers where, in the end, they'll pay twice as much for the solar system that's managed by a third party than if they had just paid cash themselves. So without some consumer protection entity, third-party financing can breed confusion, and consumers may not get the best value for their investment. And then generally, we're opposed to programs that inflate the cost of a resource just to make it viable. So obviously we're paying a lot more for this resource than we would if we're going out on the market to buy energy. And those are my comments for House Bill 2745. On House Bill 2941, I want to highlight our Blue Sky program. So PacifiCorp, as Representative Johnson mentioned, has a very successful program for allowing our customers to invest in renewable energy. Since 2006, Blue Sky customers have voluntarily funded more than 75 facilities that produce in excess of 6.5 megawatts of renewable energy. That's nearly $8 million in investment. And recently, we've announced 10 commercial-scale solar projects in our service territory for a total of $1.8 million in investment. That includes 1.0 megawatts on the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, 67.2 kilowatts in some carports in Prineville. So just two of the 10 that we've recently announced. As for House Bill 2941, our concerns are primarily focused around virtual net metering, similarly to PGE. So I won't reiterate his concerns because ours are very similar. I did want to mention the Dash 1 amendment to that bill. The VIR model could be a better model. It certainly gets around that virtual net metering problem. So we're interested in looking at that. Of course, it would be better primarily if the value of solar is used and determined to be closer to our avoided cost. So more similar to what we would pay for other energy that's out on the market. And then, again, whatever programs are deemed beneficial for Oregonians, we believe should be applied to all Oregonians, not just to our ratepayers in investor-owned utility territory. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Rep. Olby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly appreciate you looking at the bills. You know, we've had these bills out at the work group we had last January where we had these proposals. So I hadn't heard any of these concerns until right now.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm anxious for, you know, you really to participate in a work group to help solve some of these problems unless your position is you just won't support community solar. You know, I guess that I'm not sure what I'm reading here. So, but I do appreciate you looking at the Dash 1. I think it solves the issues you expressed about the virtual net metering. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, take a look at that Dash 1 and maybe get back to me. You know, I'll give you some feedback, too. I hope you do participate in a work group to look at these issues. Thank you.
Representative Johnson and all of you guys.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That statistic that was cited on the virtual—I mean, for the same cost, you could obtain 2 megawatts of solar or 80 megawatts of gas—is pretty striking. And obviously, the other difference is that the gas is a 24/7 natural gas is a 24/7 supply of electricity versus on the solar side. It's when the sun's out, which is primarily a daylight. But getting into, I think, Elizabeth, you were mentioning utility-scale solar. What could be done or what might happen to encourage more of that that could be, let's say, more scalable, have a better payback? Obviously, the investment costs more money, but as we talk about, again, if we're going to think globally here as a state of Oregon, is that a better way for us to be going or to be thinking or encouraging you all to engage in that kind of conversation versus all of these other plots of gardens popping up across the state and so forth that make people feel good but may not be the most efficient way to invest?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, utility-scale solar, certainly, and I think that Varner would remember some of these numbers, is more affordable for the energy that's coming out of a solar project. We do want to be responsive to our customers and their desires to participate in their energy future, as was stated earlier. We feel that our Blue Sky program mm-hmm. is a way that they're doing, and it's one of the most participated in programs of its like in the country. So I'll turn it to Varner to give some more details maybe about utility scale.
Chair Vega-Peters and Representative Johnson. I mean, I think that the main, striking conclusion out of the report that the Public Utilities Commission did on that Jason Eisdorfer presented earlier was that the main, in reading the report, the main way that we drive down the cost of solar, according to the report, is build bigger projects and have them be competitively bid. Competition and size are the things that really decrease the cost. And, I mean, to be fair, that sort of gas to solar equivalency is only with the historical performance of the VIR/feed-in tariff program over time to date in terms of looking backwards. It isn't necessarily a reflection of what the cost of solar necessarily is going forward relative to gas. It's more an argument about how expensive this program, especially with its focus on small installations, has been relative to other types of generation.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is really for Rep. Holvey, and he's gone now, but maybe either Elizabeth or Varner knows the answer, or you, Madam Chair. Has anybody made any plans for an amendment to include others that you know of?
Other sizes?
Oh, yeah, it said the co-ops and...
Oh, maybe. No, I think that's a starting point of the discussion.
Okay.
That may, as we put the work group together... that will probably be discussed in that.
Okay.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess when I'm looking at this and when I first saw it, when they're saying community solar programs, I'm thinking where you start a housing development and you would have solar panels built that you feed and take care of that housing development with those. And then after I got through it and I'm looking at this and they're wanting to use your transmission lines, all of your service, and then want your ratepayers to pay for them using their service. It kind of bothered me a little bit that was sort of the emphasis behind this. I'm just wondering if there's any way where maybe you could get involved in the work group to get it to more, it truly is a community, like a new development where they actually build the homes and they set them up on a system, and then they could use, would you guys be amenable to like the RETSI or where any extra power that they had fed into the system, or then it wouldn't be so much of a nightmare for you on determining this. And then they just pay for their own power. And then you could pay them the market rate of whatever the power is, because what's the open market right now for power?
Chair Vega-Peterson, Representative Widener. First, just to be clear, we're intending to participate in the work group. We've communicated that in writing to Senator Beyer that we're interested in doing so, and utilities throughout the state are interested in participating in the work group. We want to make it sure it's a functional size work group. Not being too big of a group to have a functional conversation. But I think to your question, though, I think there are a lot of different ways that you could structure these programs. And I think it's less a question about whether or not we can develop the resource. It's more of a question about how do we make sure that we've got the right accounting. This is a big part of what the Value of Solar study that the PUC is just begun, the docket that's up and running right now, is to figure out what's the right accounting to get the right pricing for different types of solar installations. And I think there are a number of different ways that we could structure programs that could be effective, and we're interested in doing so.
Yeah. If I may follow up.
Follow up.
Because what I'm getting at is self-sufficient communities is kind of where I think this needs to sort of take a direction, go to, where you have a self-sufficient community with these community solar programs. And now when they buy the house, the solar is factored into the sale price of that house, and they've paid for it themselves up front. And that would be logical to me. I think it would make sense for you guys. I just want to make sure I'm on the right path to where this is something that's feasible that you wouldn't see as an issue. Then you can scale the solar project to the housing development.
Chair Vig Peterson, Representative Widener, usually these are referred to, these types of things, as microgrids, and there's quite a bit of work going on in terms of developing these things. I think they're absolutely viable. Again, it's a question in terms of how do you design the incentives right and the pricing, but these are absolutely something that can work. And I think that, you know, generally when somebody adds something to their house that provides value, you know, either you remodel a bathroom or you put in, you know, you paint, you know, put a nice coat of paint on or put some solar on the rooftop. Those are things that can contribute to the value and increase the resale, certainly.
I think I may follow up.
Follow up.
I think you're missing what I'm saying here a little bit, Varner. This would be a new housing development, so not retrofitting to where that power is designed for that community. See what I'm getting at? So to me, that would be a community program to where the tax, your ratepayers aren't having to pay the bill for this. So now it's factored into that price of the home. So let's just say it's $1 million for the solar panels. That's factored into the 100 homes that are in that development. So in the price that they pay for that to pay for the solar, knowing that they're going to have virtually free power living in that development.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Widener, I think that's a conversation we might want to sit down and have with the home builders. Yeah. Sure, they have a perspective on it.
They would be here supporting us, you think?
I'm happy to have that conversation with John Chandler.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, certainly that does at least create a relationship between the load, the location, and the size of the generation facility, which is something we like a little better. And one of our concerns with the community scale or community solar projects, because there isn't necessarily a relationship in that case, so it is easier to manage that way.
Thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for either of you. I thought that previous testimony today indicated that for the feed-in tariff impact on a monthly basis on the bill was between 25 cents and $1.50 a month, and wanted to get your hit on that. And is that the right ballpark?
Chair Vig Peterson, Representative Helm. The report from the PUC has on page 9 estimated rate impacts to date, and they list the rate impacts as a percentage of the revenue requirement, which is basically the total expenses that go into rate making for a utility. Jason can correct me on how I probably did that a little bit off. For PGE, it's listed as 0.28%, PacifiCorp 0.22%, and Idaho Power is 1.3% of revenue requirement. So that generally translates to revenue requirements are generally passed through as an expense, so about a 0.28% rate increase. And I think what Mr. Pingilly was doing in his testimony was saying the average bill for PGE customer, generally speaking, is about $100 a month, and a 0.28% rate increase would work out to be about a quarter. Or about 25 cents, something in that range. That's I believe, what the math was that was being referenced. What I was taking issue with was the comparison to the Cardi Generating Station, new gas plant, and that proportionality.
Follow up.
So I can't help drawing a comparison between the bottle redemption program we were talking about a couple of weeks ago and how we're trying to encourage more people to take their unused cans to the redemption facility so we get them in waste stream. So it seems like if we could just get people to bring between 5 and 15 more cans back to the redemption center in these territories, that we'd be able to pay for this program.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vernon, I appreciate you bringing out that percentage. I mean, it looks like a minuscule number, but if that's multiplied by the number of rate payers and the number of bills that people are paying, that would be a fairly significant amount of money on a dollar basis, would it not?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. We have a total revenue requirement that's going to be in the range of about $1.7 billion. So 0.28% of that works out to be a pretty significant number. And I think that mostly the argument we're trying to make is what's the bang for the buck or the return on the investment, which is how much solar are you getting for that? And I think that the argument we would make is if you do bigger projects, especially bigger projects in sunnier places, with those 5 or 10 soda cans or beer cans, not discriminating on that, that you could get 2 to 4 times as much solar.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. We're going to have about 3 more panels to come up, so I'm going to ask that everybody be brief in their testimony, or request that you please try to be brief in your testimony. Let's have Rhett Lawrence, Lauren Anderson, and Jeff Bissonette.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. On behalf of the more than 20,000 members and supporters of the Sierra Club in Oregon, I did want to offer our enthusiastic support for both of these bills. I will be brief. I have submitted written testimony, and much of what I would have said otherwise has been covered by others. But as an organization with a long history working in support of renewable energy in Oregon, we believe that both of these bills can go a long way toward continuing the expansion of solar power in our state. Solar energy is a critical component of Oregon's clean energy mix, and its importance is only growing. Living in an increasingly carbon-constrained world, we need to be exploiting and promoting renewable energy wherever we can. So you've already heard what the bills do. I won't go into that. I'll just again say that we strongly support extending the feed-in tariff through House Bill 2745 and creating the Solar Gardens Program in 2941. We believe these can go a long way towards promoting more solar energy and renewable technology in Oregon, and so we would urge your support of these bills as well. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lauren Anderson. I'm in the Masters of Public Policy program at Oregon State University. I've never testified before, but I drove up from Corvallis today to support solar energy. My background is in biology. I worked for a couple years in the field of applied animal and applied plant ecology. I decided to change into environmental and energy policy at Oregon State because I felt that this was the best way to make a difference and protect the environment quickly. I feel that clean energy policies are the best way to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. I spent a lot of time exploring Oregon. It's a very special state, a very beautiful state, and I want to do everything I can to make sure that future generations have the same opportunities that I have had. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonette with the Citizens Utility Board representing residential ratepayers. I signed up on the chart as neutral on the feed-in tariff extension bill and supporting the community solar bill. And some of the discussion that we had earlier with Senator Beyer and Representative Holvey kicking a lot of this to a work group, I think, makes a lot of sense. On the feed-in tariff pilot front, keyword to us is sort of pilot, and we've been working with this program now for a while, and to this point haven't heard sort of a very convincing conversation about why to continue the pilot or what more we have to learn from the pilot. It's not saying that argument doesn't exist and we're open to it, and the work group is probably the place to explore those issues. We would really like to explore not just pilots, but programs that you could make permanent that can scale up system-wide and really focus our attention, our energy, if you will, and our resources to those ends. And because of that, the community solar, we think, has a lot of potential. There are certainly, I think the bill as introduced, as you've heard, has some bumps to it, but I think that we don't have to just transplant the community solar garden bill from Colorado, but we can sort of take some of those principles, take some of the principles actually that we've learned from the feed-in tariff pilot, like the reverse auction mechanism that you heard about earlier, and figure out how to apply them in a community solar context. And that's what we would encourage as the next step, and we'd be happy to participate if the chair and others thought that that would be helpful.
Thank you so much. Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Might be a little more of a comment, but what was your name again?
Lauren Anderson.
Lauren Anderson. You did awesome today being here with us and everything. This little bit of a comment for you and for the Sierra Club, because I understand why solar and everything is so powerful, but one of the issues that I do have, because I am huge on conservation, I've lived in Oregon my entire life, my family was here in the mid-1800s, I actually don't like having people live around me. My brother, his prime place to live would be in Druzy, Oregon, outside of Burns, just to give you an idea. But one of the issues that I do have with a lot of the stuff that we are doing with these solar projects, with the wind, is there a little bit of an eyesore at times out, I mean, when you drive up the gorge and things like that. And I would like you to look at that impact that it does have on our environment and everything, especially at Oregon State. This is stuff that you're studying to take back and discuss with them. Some of these huge solar projects, you're basically, that land is tied up. But I can see, I've actually teased Representative Bence about it, who's working on another project today. But I said this is going to be a place for the sage grouse to hide, and I might have to pop out a few solar panels so I can get one sometime, you know, when they open hunting season for them. But these are things that I think we need to take into serious consideration, and I know you guys are environmental advocates, and I would really like you to look at this very closely. I mean, just showing up and supporting, but think of what it does to our land in an overall aspect, because we are losing valuable farm ground and things like that with some of these larger solar projects, because it takes a lot of land to power homes with these. So it's a little bit of a comment for you. But I want to look at the whole picture when we're doing a lot of this stuff and what truly is best for our environment. So,
appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Next, we're going to call up, I can't read this, Pat Schelling. We'll go with that. Jamie Valdez and Margaret Wills. And if we've lost, if we've lost a couple people, then I'm going to go ahead and call up Mark Darinetto, Peter C. Okay. So does my husband. Don't feel bad. Thank you.
So go ahead and start.
All right. Please go ahead and state your name for the record when you're ready.
Peter Greenberg, EnergyWise.
Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't really plan on talking. I just thought I was signing up for attendance. But we're probably the largest private owner of solar in the state, and did about probably 20% of the feed-in tariff program. And we're the largest owner of solar on public schools, churches, nonprofits, Indian tribes, farms, and soon-to-be apartments. And for most of the people, we own all our systems, and for most of the systems, schools wouldn't buy a system, and we're giving them, you know, part of the money coming in from the feed-in tariff program, and over the 15 years, they're getting about $4 million that they wouldn't have before. So we got systems on schools in Albany and Turner and Jefferson and, not Jefferson, but Turner, Mount Angel, Silverton, Newburgh, George Fox, down in Medford. And just a quick comment about the community solar, which I think is a very good idea. You really need net metering. If you put a solar system in a house in Corvallis, let's say, 75% of homes in Oregon, either or people in Oregon, either have trees or renters or don't own homes. So the community solar, like they have in many states, I think Washington, California, Massachusetts, Colorado, lets people own a part of it. But a solar system on the ground is about 10 or 15% more efficient than on a house. If you put it on a single access tracker, if you have a big enough system, you're adding another 15 or 20%. In Pacific Power, if you put it in the sunnier areas, either east or south, you're adding another 35 or 40%. So you're building a bigger system, which is more cost effective and a more efficient system. So you're getting a lot more bang for your buck for people that want to do solar but couldn't in many cases.
Thank you.
But if you have any questions, you know, we got a lot of systems out there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is James Valdez, and I'm here representing Northwest Sustainable Energy for Economic Development, also known as Northwest SEED. We're a regional nonprofit dedicated to promoting a distributed sustainable energy future, and we work with utilities, local governments, and community groups in both Oregon and Washington to reduce barriers to renewable energy adoption. Here in Oregon, we've been working for the last 3 years or so on something called Northwest Solar Communities, which looks to remove some of those soft cost barriers that you heard that help reduce the total installed costs of solar energy systems. We've also, in Washington State, had experience with community solar and have helped promote and build programs that have had over 2,000 different participants throughout a number of different systems. So we understand the decisions that customers must weigh in going solar, and we have really found that simplicity and predictability of incentives is key to developing the market. This bill, House Bill 2941, does provide that mechanism, and we think that the bill credit is simple to understand and a valuable tool that we could use here in Oregon. So we're very supportive of the Community Solar Gardens bill. The vast majority of residents don't have the opportunity to install on their own homes, and this legislation builds on successful models of community participation and engagement that can have multiple benefits in addition to just the energy being produced. Over 8 other states have established community solar policies, and we feel that the time is right for Oregon too as well. And so this bill does provide the framework for citizens to join together in building that renewable energy future. In regard to some of the details that some of the utilities have brought up, I think that all of those are resolvable. The PUC, as I see directed in the latest versions of the bill, is directed to do some rate making and adjustment of the value that participants would receive. We would just urge, if as this moves forward, that the value proposition be similar to that residential customers would receive if they were doing that system on their own property. And so regardless of the mechanism that it might take to do that, we see that there should be equity and some parity between those investments. There's also a few kind of administrative details where we feel there could be benefits to an efficient community solar program, and so we welcome an opportunity to participate in a work group and remain engaged in the conversation. So I won't go through any of those details out of the nature of the time we're at here. But thank you to you and for the committee in for your time and consideration, and we look forward to remaining engaged in the process.
Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Mark D'Arienzo, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm representing the ASME, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees Green Caucus, and we support HB 2941 and 2745. We feel it will create jobs, it will protect the environment by reducing greenhouse gases. We think it's a win-win situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. Peter, is that right? Where are you guys located?
Live in Albany.
Albany. So you own the systems, so you just lease it to the...
No, we own them.
You just run it. You just
put it on them. And then give them a set fee each year. Okay. I just handed a check to Newburgh Schools yesterday for $14,000. They named a urinal after me. I put Aim High over it.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you guys very much. We have, if they're still here, Dave King and Abby Noel. And if there's anyone else who's here to testify on these bills, please come forward now, because this is the last panel.
You want to go first?
Sure.
Thanks, Dave. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for your patience and sticking with us today. Obviously, we have a passionate group here. My name is Andy Knoll. I'm a current board member for Solar Oregon. I have some brief comments today to establish our support for both HB 2745 and 2941. Let me give you some brief background on Solar Oregon, and I will talk quickly through this section. The organization was established in 1979. We are a 501c3, and we focus on providing education about solar energy to the public. We have about 40 active volunteers for our organization that provide over 1,000 volunteer hours per year. We have roughly 60,000 visits to our website and just under 10,000 individuals on our email list. Our staff, board, and the volunteers work together to provide educational solar workshops for the public. We also provide industry-related professional conferences, and as you'd imagine, here in Oregon, we have our famous solar wine tour where we visit solar-powered wineries, all of which are geared toward providing trusted education about the benefits of solar energy to the public. As most of us are aware and has been discussed much today, the price of solar has dropped by more than half over roughly the last 7 years. But it's the advancement in solar product innovation to the consumers, that is, which is equally impressive and a big reason for the increased consumer participation rates in solar. And when I say solar product innovation, I really mean the way that consumers, whether it's businesses or residents, the way that they can actually procure solar. As an example, when I started personally in the industry in 2007, Oregon was averaging about 1,000 installed systems per year. Now we are at over 8,000 installed systems per year. But at that time in 2007, there was no third-party financing options for residential solar. Now the majority of residential solar systems are third-party financed. The market innovation for solar is something we feel should be continued and encouraged legislatively. And for this reason, we support specifically community solar as an example of market innovation for solar products to consumers. Community solar can provide additional ways for consumers to directly participate in solar, as we've discussed today. The power of its concept is that it reaches the roughly 80% of the population that cannot currently put solar on their home or on their business. It's also a product which can be provided by a utility that allows their customers to own part of an offsite solar facility, and I'll key on that, own part of an offsite solar facility and directly receive the energy benefits along with a payback, not just a cost premium. We all know that community solar means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, but we should identify the difference between green power programs offered by the utility that are a check of the box on a bill to support renewable energy versus true ownership in a project which provides you a payback on your investment. Those are two significantly different things and two significantly different value propositions to the consumer. Let's also not forget that the end product, i.e. that solar facility itself, is attractively sized. These are large enough to gain in economies of scale and the construction costs, yet they're small enough to fit in and around communities, as well as fit nicely on a utility's distribution system, providing a local resource value. If I take my Solar Oregon hat off for a second and put on my technical solar hat, I think you could have a healthy debate with the point that Mr. Varner from PGE made before about the difference between net metering being a system on somebody's house and a larger distributed generation facility being in the Hillsboro-Beaverton example. A 500 kW project in Hillsboro is going to be immediately absorbed on the distribution system, very similar because of the load in those communities, very similar to how a net metered system on a home is. Regarding HB 2745 and the continuation of the VIR, we see that the uniqueness of this is that it has significantly reached the small commercial segment as well as the nonprofit segment within the state of Oregon. It's produced incentive structure that has allowed Oregon-based third-party financing options that we heard before to exist, which previously did not. Specifically, we've seen this from our organization be very popular in the agricultural sector of Oregon, and the projects have also supported the solar and electrical contractors in the eastern and southern parts of the state as well. One thing I thought I would mention that hasn't been mentioned today is that churches have been very active in the VIR. We work with a lot of churches and have so in the past. And there's a term that they're using more and more now. It's called caring for creation, which is their way of talking about environmental responsibility. And many churches are using or have used the VIR as a way to, as a platform, I should say, of becoming their caring for creation with their community. On the cost aspect of the VIR, I just encourage the committee to always realize when talking about the different cost examples that there's a significant difference between the cost of the past or initial establishment of the VIR versus the rates that we're talking about now. Those are two different things.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Go ahead. And, sir, did you want to also testify? So, all right.
Go ahead, Jack.
My name's Jack Herbert. I'm live in Cedar Hills. And I'd like to speak for HB 2941 and 2745. 2941 would allow me to buy, pay for solar somewhere else. I have a wonderful wooded lot. I love the trees. Energy Trust of Oregon came out and said, your roof doesn't qualify anywhere. But out on my southern property line over my rhododendrons, which could use some shade, it would. Now think about the cost of setting up a whole system, all the support for that, versus buying into a big system somewhere else. You're going to get a lot more solar than me shading my rhododendrons, I think. So 2941 seems to make sense. And 2745, well, it's a feed-in tariff that allowed Germany to just grow their solar drastically, right? That's what made it work. And if the Germans are smart enough to make it work, I mean, we may not be as smart as they are, but we ought to be smart enough to make it work. And so I think we ought to do that.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Dave King. I'm a retired carpenter and mental health worker and a current working landlord of three houses. I'm with the Climate Jobs PDX committee. We're a small committee, but we're growing, and our mission is to generate support for dealing with climate change, and by making people realize that there's a lot more work involved in doing that than there is in fossil fuels. So we're young and growing. We're very, very concerned about our climate. Carbon pollution, ocean acidification, and the effect of burning fossil fuels. We're going through a crisis. Global warming is happening as we speak. The recent storms back east are clearly a consequence of carbon. Just in case you've been looking at Fox News, the warming Arctic slows the jet stream and it wobbles when it goes slower. When it does that, it brings Arctic air down into the south, and when that mixes with warm, moist air off the ocean, we got another record-breaking storm. Closer to home, the lack of snow this winter has affected winter sports, but even more serious, it's going to be lowering the water levels in our rivers with consequences for agriculture and river transportation, and my boat probably will be aground where it's usually moored. And we're just seeing the beginning now. The carbon that came out of our tailpipes when we came here today will be helping to keep the sun's heat on the planet for 75 years. We've really got to stop this now. Addressing all these issues of stopping carbon pollution in our atmosphere and our oceans, as well as to adapting to the devastating consequences that it will happen, will take a lot of work. We believe addressing these things is totally possible. We will need to mobilize our workforce, as has only been done once before in World War II. The legislation before you is a no-brainer. Good for Oregon, good for quality jobs, good for the grid, good for the general fund, and good for my buddies, the fishes and the oysters. Thank you. And please pass these bills and a whole lot more, like the carbon tax.
Thank you all very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, colleagues, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2745 and House Bill 2941. I think those of us who stick around get to go on the wine and solar tour is what I'm thinking. So thank you all.
Is that happening tonight?
Yeah. And with that, I'm going to go close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.
She's serious?
House Energy and Environment Committee. Thank you.
She's serious?
Meeting of the